to Romans chapter 13, and we need to look at verses 5, 6, and 7. This is a very fascinating concept here, which is the idea of taxes. And I'd never done anything myself on, is there a biblical concept on taxes? And I made some very, very interesting discovery. One of them is that the basic tax in Israel was a straight 10% for everybody. And you look at that and say, well, that's fair. But then you begin to trace through the rest of the Old Testament, and every time Israel left that tax base, taxes went up. And we'll try to establish this with several passages that make it very clear. But tonight, we want to look at verses 5, 6, and 7. Romans 13, 5, 6, and 7 really combines the teaching of Paul and Jesus on the subject of taxes. And this is, again, just by way of introduction to it. Romans chapter 13, verses 5 through 7, combines the teaching of Paul and Jesus on the subject of taxes. 13, 5, and 6 refers to the teaching of Paul. And therefore, in verse 5, wherefore it is necessary to be in subjection, that is, to civil authorities, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. And so Paul emphasizes that for the believer, there's dual motivation on taxes and submission. Dual motives. And they are, number one, government. And they are, number two, God. And so the emphasis, first of all, in verse 5, coming to a conclusion, is that you must be in subjection to civil authorities, not only because of wrath. So the government, because of fear. But not only is that the motivation for a Christian, but it should also be for conscience sake. So it is fear of government and respect for God. And notice that's true of all horizontal relationships in the Bible. We may have to submit and cooperate on a human level with someone or some entity that is detestable and that is hard to get along with, that may abuse and misuse us, but the Christian always leaps over his obedience there and goes back to, we do it as unto the Lord. And therefore the dual motives come up in this this context. So notice then, dual motives of the Christian. And notice also, the Christian's responsibility to the government runs deeper than the unbeliever. We all the more ought to be cooperative with authority because of our relationship to God. So the motive for the Christian runs deeper, much deeper than it does to God. Romans 13 and verse 7 brings in the teaching of Jesus on the subject. And the teaching of Jesus then is taken from not only this passage but one other, but this is the key one. It's Mark 12, 14 through 17. And I think when Paul wrote what we have in verse 6 and 7, he says, for because of this, you also pay taxes. For rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing, that is, collecting taxes. Render to all that is due them. Now that's coming from Jesus' mouth in Mark 12, 14 through 17. Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. And I think when we go to verse 8, though, we'll not get there tonight. We have a verse that has, in the last few years, I think, been terribly abused. It's been taken to mean that verse 8 says you cannot have a house mortgage. You cannot owe on your car. But it's unbiblical to take a loan, and therefore their reasoning is, owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. And that's taken to cover the whole gamut of all credit. And it says a Christian, and some teach this, that a Christian must pay cash for everything. Credit is not legitimate by this verse. That doesn't fit the context well, does it? What is the context of verse 6? Taxes. context of verse 7. Render to everyone that is due them tax for tax, custom for custom. And I take it verse 8 ought to best be taken in the light of its precise context is pay your taxes. Don't owe what is legitimately given in terms of tribute or custom, and we'll talk about that word later, and tax, respect, and honor for position. But we'll deal with that verse later. So notice then there is a link, a direct link, between Romans 13:7, the words of Paul, and Mark 12:17, the words of Jesus. Now here's the parallel. Verse 7 begins by saying render. And the word render grammatically refers to the following things. It is an aorist, so make a definite act of it, and it's an imperative. This is an order. It's an appeal to volition. So with the word render, Paul picks up on Mark 12:17, and let's flip back to that, Mark 12:17. It's hard to think that Paul didn't remember the words of Jesus exactly, because he uses exactly the same word that Jesus used on the subject. Verse 17, Jesus said to them, render. And that's exactly the same word, aorist, imperative, same tense, same mood, same voice, same spelling, letter for letter is identical. So I take it Paul then must have pulled this out of the teaching of Jesus when he said render, using the same tense, the same appeal to the volition. And I take it when Paul does his teaching on taxes, he said we're going to go right back to the mouth of Jesus and take out the same words that he uses in this context. Now, going back to 13:7, notice you have a list of terms. You have the term tax. You have the term custom. You have the word fear. And you have the word honor. And it's taxes to whom taxes are due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, and honor to whom honor. So what is the distinction in those words? First of all, in 13:7, render to all what is due them, echoing the words of Jesus. Tax to whom tax. And the word that is used for tax has to do with two kinds, personal and property. It had to do with personal and property taxes. So we could expand in verse 7, render to all what is due them, personal and property tax, to whom personal and property tax is due. The second word is custom. And that was a word that had to do with import and export tax. Import and export tax. Fear points to attitude with which this is done, and it's the attitude of respect toward those in leadership. And we need to emphasize, not because of their character, but because of their position. Then finally, the word honor is simply a word for respect the office that they represent. Respect the office that they hold. So that tonight, from these words, we want to expand out into the following subject. Tithes, taxes, and tribute in the Bible. The difference between the last two, taxes are taken from within. Tribute is from without, such as a foreign state taking money from or paying money to them. So this really covers the whole area, and actually, the word that we have for tithes in the Old Testament is here. So let's begin with the word tithe. And I'm going to put parenthetically, the tithe was the Old Testament tax. The word that is used in the New Testament that is translated tithe is a Greek word that means to give one-tenth. The word tithe, apa kata tuo in Greek, means to give 10%. That was the whole tax system as God instituted it in Israel. Notice it's across the board. Everybody pays exactly the same thing. And this was the fundamental and concept that was here. We might say a couple of things about the tithe. That, first of all, it did not originate in the law. It did not originate in the law of Moses. It was practiced not only before Moses by Israelites, but it was practiced by many other nations, and I would underscore many other nations in antiquity, said the only way for the state to righteously and fairly take money from her people is on the basis that everybody, irrespective of your scale, paid the same thing. No, not the same thing, same percent. So if you made a million, 10%. If you made a half a million, 10%. If you made $10, your taxes are $1. And the thing you can say for that, first of all, is why do you think many ancient nations other than Israel might have used the tithe? For example, go back to Genesis. Now, it's true, the tithe, or the 10%, is in the law of Moses. But you go way back beyond Moses and go back to the practice that was practiced by Abraham. And you come down to his meeting with, well, verse 17. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and all the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him in the valley of Sheva, that is the king's valley. Melchizedek sent a king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of the Most High God. He meets this person, and in the last part of verse 12, he gave him a tenth of all. That is simply the word tithe. He tithed. And it meant to give 10% of what you had. Why do you think, now forget the number of 10%, why do you think many of the nations, including Israel and including the law of Moses, why do you think they would practice a straight across-the-board percentage tax? What does that have to recommend it to you? That's right. That's true. Doesn't it recommend to us imminent fairness? So the idea is this, and the nations that practiced it, it was based on fairness. They didn't bracket people. It was simply everybody does the same thing. Now, when we talk about taxes in Israel, we need to consider several things, or let's just put it down, aspects of taxes in Israel. Number one, the amount, the payee, and the place. First of all, the tithe, how much? The tithe, how much? Then to whom, and then where? First, the tithe. How much? Leviticus 27 is our key passage on that. Leviticus chapter 27. Key passage on taxation in Israel, or what they call the tithe. Everybody gives 10%. We're using Leviticus 27, 30 through 32, as our passage. Verse 30. Thus all the tithe, or the 10% of the land, of the seed of the land, or of the fruit tree, is the Lord's, it's holy to the Lord. If therefore a man omits to redeem part of the tithe, etc. Verse 32, I'll come back to that. And for every tenth part of the herd or flock, you see the three categories? In Israel, crops, that would be fruit of the, that would be seed of the land, crops, fruit of the tree, that would be orchards. And then finally, in verse 32, every tenth of the herd or flock. So you were taxed in Israel on crops, orchards, and cattle. Now, how did they do it? The crops and orchards would be easy to find 10% there. The cattle, you tithe your cattle as they went out to the field. So that the method of counting would be to have a stick, and you would touch the lamb or the cattle as it went out, and you'd count one, two, three, like a what's the gate you go through? The turnstile. A toll gate type thing. And therefore, it would. Here comes the cattle. You go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, taken out for a tithe, then recount again up. And notice he explains that down in verse 32. For every tenth part of the herd or flock, whatever passes under the rod, and the rod was for accounting and for them, the tenth one shall be holy to the Lord. Notice something else. You see something else that this 10% would do? If you had cattle and wanted to give 10%, what 10% would you give to the government? Come on. What 10% would you give? I'd give the rattiest lamb of the whole bunch, wouldn't you? Or the skinniest or the sickliest cow, so that God would get all the sick cows and sick sheep. But notice the way they had to do it. You couldn't do that. Because the cattle, it would be very hard to present the lambs and say, you lambs, now the nine healthy ones get in line first and the tenth one follow, then start all over again. So you really couldn't cheat. Whatever came up at the tenth one, you might say, oh, that was a prize. But that's okay. It's the tenth one to go under the counting rod, and consequently there. So there's fairness. There's no means for cheating involved in it. Now there's one other little stipulation. Could you, instead of giving the cattle or the herds, could you give the cash value at 10%? Could you do that? Could you say, I want to keep the herds, but I'd like to keep the cash value? Well, the answer is split. Notice verse 31 stipulates that you can tithe crops or orchards in the form of cash value. But when you do so, what must you do? You must add one-fifth to your 10%. So you were allowed, again, verse 31, if therefore a man wishes to redeem part of his tithe, he shall add one-fifth to it. So you could turn in the tithe in form of cash value. Then when you did that, you had to take whatever your cash value was and add a fifth to it in order to do it. You couldn't do it with your flocks, and you couldn't do it with your herds. You could do it with your produce. So crops and orchards, but not cattle, could be exchanged in this this basis. Okay, that's the passage then. Crops, orchards and are one category, and cattle are another. And this would assure, again, fairness. And, enforces, so they couldn't pick out, what would be the word for it, so they couldn't pick out the scrawny ones. Assures fairness and even-handed tax, I guess you'd call it, even-handed. Now, when you did this, to whom did you pay it? The tithe, now, how much, now, to whom? And again, the thing we're going to want to emphasize, whenever Israel left the across-the-board 10% tax, taxes always went out the roof. And what ultimately was it that split the nation in two? Tax revolt. southern northern kingdom revolted, and it was over the issue of taxes. Now, to whom? Numbers 18, 21, 24. Numbers begins to point out that the tax base in Israel was very narrow. You didn't have to pay taxes on very much. The tax in Israel was only on the tabernacle and its servants. 10%. In Israel was used to carry on the activity of the tabernacle and the servants of it. So looking at Numbers 18, verse 21. And to the sons of Levi, behold, I have given all the tithe or tax in Israel for an inheritance in reward for their service which they perform, the service of the tabernacle or of the tent of meeting. And that was it. That was all that was taxed in Israel. However, when that 10% went to, or so we have taxes to the Levites. Would you like to be a Levite? Sounds like a very lucrative type thing. And so God says, it all goes to the Levites, but what do the Levites have to do? Of all the taxes they receive, they have to tithe a tithe of their taxes. And if you look down to verse 24, for the tithe of the sons of Israel, which they offer as an offering to the Lord, I've given to the Levites for an inheritance, for I've said concerning them, they shall have no inheritance in the land of Israel. And if you come down to verse 27, verse 26, moreover, you shall speak to the Levites and say to them, when you take from the sons of Israel the tithe, the 10% which I have given to you for your inheritance, then you shall present an offering from it to the Lord, a tithe of the tithe. Sound fair? So that the principle, again, of fairness was to the Levites, and they, in turn, tithed tithes. They tithed the 10%. Okay, that's the to whom. Now, where? Taxes, where? Were they to be paid? Deuteronomy 12, beginning with verse 5. Deuteronomy 12, beginning with verse 5. And the point we want to note first is that the tithe went to a divinely selected place. God selected where the tithes were to be brought, and he does so in Deuteronomy 12, verses 5 and 6. But you shall seek the Lord at the place which your Lord God shall choose from among all your tribes, to establish his name there for his dwelling, and there you shall come. So the place, obviously, is going to be Jerusalem. As the text develops later. There, in verse 6, there you shall bring your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your taxes, or your tithes, the contribution of your hand, your votive offerings, your freewill offerings, and the firstborn of your herd and of your flock. So note, it's all centralized in Jerusalem. Later, that was at the temple. The temple had attached to it the treasury. There was an attached building to the temple, and it was the treasury. Now, let's see. I think it's Malachi, but surely we have a good Southern Baptist here that can lead us to that verse, bring all your tithes into the storehouse. It's Malachi, right? Malachi refers to it. I thought surely someone would be right on the edge of their seat with that one. Bring all your tithes into the storehouse, and I'll be able to find it. Do you believe me that there is such a verse? Okay. And I may be wrong that it's about
3:10.
There you go. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, so that there may be food in my house, and test me now in this. And the tithe again was not only, remember the tithe was your cattle. See, we think differently. We think of taxes only in terms of money. We think of wealth in terms of money. Ancient people didn't think of that much about coinage. Wealth was garments, wine, grain, agriculture. That was the main source of wealth in these times. And in Malachi 3:10, the command is to bring the tithe into the storehouse, and the storehouse would be a building attached to the temple. Now, I think you can see it's a far leap if I should get up Sunday morning and say, bring all of your tithes into the storehouse. Your tithes is 10%, and this is the storehouse. That's not true, but it was as far as Israel was concerned, and that's the way they did it. Now, let me show you, coming off of this, what happened when they left the across-the-board tax. What happened to the nation? Number one, and there's a tie-in with relationship to God and the nation's taxation. And so notice here, three sentences will start this. When they rejected, God's system as a nation for taxation, several things happened. One, taxes went up. First Samuel, verse 8. 1 Samuel 8. And 1 Samuel 8 is where Israel will come to a point where she's going to reject God's way of doing things, which we've established at this point. It was a very simple, across-the-board 10% tax. And in 1 Samuel chapter 8, it came about when Samuel was old that he appointed his sons judges over Israel. The name of the firstborn was Joel, the name of the second of Abijah, and they were judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain and took bribes and perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together, came to Samuel at Ramah, and they said to him, "Behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways." Now notice the flavor. They want to be international in character. They want to emulate every other nation on earth and be the same. Now, they say, appoint us a king for to judge us like all the nations. So notice how taxes are going to go up, but notice it was preceded by a spirit of internationalism. And that simply means the world is one great community. We do not want to be unique. We do not want to be different. We want to be universal. We want to be like everybody else. We want to be part of the world community. Put it that way. We want to be part of the world community in terms of government. And for that reason, we reject the leadership we've had, and we want something new. Well, God warns them of what is going to happen when this occurs. The international community did not tax 10%. Their system was unfair in the respect that they were oppressed, they were excessively taxed, and Israel said, "We want to be like that." So, verse 7. The Lord said to Samuel, "Listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, they have rejected me from being king over them." That's the spiritual aspect of it. But God cannot be set aside without hitting everything else. God cannot be set aside without it hitting your economy. He cannot be set aside without hitting your trade. He cannot be set aside without hitting your educational system. Everything that happens when God is rejected goes bad. So, verse 7, "Listen to the voice of the people, regard all that they say to you, that they have not rejected you, they have rejected me from being king over them."
And so forth and so forth. Now, verse 9, listen to their voice, however you shall solemnly warn them, and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel spoke all the words of the Lord to the people who had asked of the king, and notice the net result. We'll read, summarize and then read. The net result was loss of freedom. Net result was loss of freedom, and they literally became slaves of the state. Loss of freedom, they became slaves of the state. In every way, start reading down in verse 11. This will be the procedure of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and place them for himself in his chariots. That's loss of freedom. And among his horsemen, and they will run before his chariots. He will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and fifties, and some to do his plowing and to reap his harvest, to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will also take your daughters for perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and your vineyards and your olive groves. No, he will take the best. He will not take 10%. He will take the best of all of these. And verse 15, he will take a tenth of your seed and your vineyards, give to his officers, to his servants. He will take your male servants, your female servants, your best young men, your donkeys, and use them for his work. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his servants. Notice, slavery is going to occur out of this. Then, verse 18, you'll cry out in that day because of your king whom you've chosen for yourself, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. It's too late. The consequences are in order. So notice, when they rejected God's system, he says taxes are going to go up. Did they? Did what God said in this section ever happen? Well, yes. But let me add a second point, and then we'll go to passages. When they left God's system, taxes went up. Number two, when they rejected God's system, they were sapped of their resources by foreign power. They were sapped of resources by foreign power. What did they want? We want to be like all the nations. We want an international attitude. And this sapped them of, they were sapped of their resources by foreign kings and nations. Go, for example, to 2 Kings 15. 2 Kings 15. Keep in mind, God's system of taxation is now set aside, and they want to be like the other nations, and the other nations will eat them alive. 2 Kings 15. And we're looking, we'll look at two passages, 15, 19, and 20. The process of extortion begins. It says, Pul, king of Syria, came against the land, and Menahem, that's the king of Israel, gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver, so that his hand might be with him to strengthen the kingdom under his rule. Bought peace. Then Menahem exacted the money from Israel, even from all the mighty men of wealth, from each man 50 shekels of silver to pay to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria returned and did not remain there in the land. In other words, we'll pay off the king of Assyria so he won't rip us up. And the way we do it is we become a slave state and we channel money to him. Same book, verse 20, chapter 23. Same book, chapter 23 and verse 35. So Jehoiakim, that's the king of Israel, Jehoiakim gave the silver and the gold to Pharaoh. And when he had to pay Pharaoh off down in Egypt and meet the foreign obligations, where did he get the money? He taxed the land in order to give the money at the command of Pharaoh. So the foreign alignment drains financially. How do you pay for it? You pay for it by increasing taxes on your own people. So he exacted the silver and the gold from the people of the land, each according to his valuation, to give it to Pharaoh Necho.
And you have this as a thread throughout that. Now, did the king's lifestyle do what Samuel said it was going to do? Did he really drain them? Well, though he had many good things going for him, let me point out a king's lifestyle, the king's lifestyle that was a heavy drain. 1 Kings 4. 1 Kings 4. They shifted from the objectivity of the tithe, 10%, to the subjectivity of the government or of the king. And so in 1 Kings chapter 4, verse 22. Now going back to, verse 22. Here's a little resume of what it costs to keep the king in business. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores. And if you notice over in your margin, a core is about 10 bushel. 300 bushels of fine flour. 60 be 600 cores of meal. 10 fat oxen. That's for a day. 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture fed oxen, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. For he had dominion over everything west of the river, so forth and so forth. And we come to later verses. Solomon had 40,000, verse 26, 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots, 12,000 horsemen. And those deputies provided for King Solomon, all who came to Solomon's table, each in his month. They left nothing lacking. And so notice you have, hey, who's going to finance this? Who's going to pay for this? The people of Israel paid for it. God didn't intend it. God said 10% across the board. You want to go your own way? Okay, you're going to have to pay the price of having a king, which they did. Look at chapter 4, how the complex taxing system gets organized, where you had commissioners appointed over 12 tax districts. Verse 7, Solomon had 12 deputies over all Israel who provided for the king and his household. Each man had to provide for a month in the year. And these are their names. Ben Hur in the hill country of Ephraim. How did he provide for his month? By taxing the people of the hill country of Ephraim, naturally. Ben Decker in, well, forget it, but you got 12 of them there. And the means of doing it was by means of taxation. When this starts, a government never, ever backs off. It only does one thing. Spends its time finding more things to tax. I don't know whether I want... I don't think I'll tell you where this verse is, because Congressman might get a hold of it. Oh, well. Amos 7:1. Amos 7:1. Thankfully, no one, to my knowledge, in our Congress has thought of this one, but if they would read Amos, they might say, hey, there's a new one to tax. And here was their thinking. Thus, this is Amos 7:1, thus the Lord showed me, and behold, he was forming a locust swarm when the spring crop began to sprout. And behold, the spring crop was after the king's, the government's mowing. The first mowing of the year was taxed. Can you imagine cutting your crops, and the very first crop is grabbed by the government? So they tax the first mowing of the year. So the people in government are no more ingenious today than they were back then in terms of placing taxes on people. Now, let me give you a read in our closing part, a few things to you. And these are both from very dependable histories. Keep in mind, in Romans 13 rather, the taxes that Christians are commanded to pay were to the Roman government. So it might be interesting to see, and maybe it'll even give us some relief, to say if paying taxes to the Roman government was any more pleasant and any fairer than perhaps our paying taxes was. I'm reading from Daily Life in Ancient Rome, one of the Corcapino was a French scholar. This is published by Yale University Press. It's a good, dependable history book. The emperor's wealth. Now, this is what Christians, when they're told pay your taxes, this is what they had to pay it to. The emperor's wealth did not consist alone in the accumulated riches of his family or predecessors. Over and above all of his possessions, nothing prevented his replenishing his private purse from the report sources of the imperial exchequer, into which poured the taxes levied for the maintenance of the soldiers, and no one ever dared suggest an audit of his accounts. Now, it all goes into tax from the people. It belongs to the king, and no accounting is done, and no one could ever say you have to account for your funds. He could dispose at will, with no need to account to any man, of all the revenues of Egypt, which was the personal possession of the crown, and he could plunge open hands into the booty of war. To cite one instance, Trajan in 106 pounced on the entire treasure of Decebalus and made speed to reorganize for his personal benefit every source of profit from his recent conflicts. He became an authentic millionaire whose authority was buttressed less on the loyalty of his legions than on the power of unlimited action conferred on an unrivaled private fortune, inexhaustible and totally uncontrolled. Almost as great a gulf separated him in the government from the plutocrats of Rome as yawned between the middle classes and the plutocracy of Rome. Same book. This is interesting. And if you want to think of the luxury in which these men lived, our congressmen really need to read what the imperial rulers and emperors of Rome did. Get this now. The emperor, who had complete control over the exchequers, it's called, or the treasury, the emperor had as many categories of slaves to arrange and tend his wardrobe as he had several types of clothes. Yeah, you could be the secretary of underwear. And it sounds funny, but listen to this. And they give all the Latin terms for it, and I have no Latin, so I cannot pronounce these. I'll try a little bit if you've had Latin, pardon me. For his palace garments, they had a vest privata for his city clothes, vest forensa for his undress military uniforms, vest castrensi for his full dress parade uniforms, a vest triumphali for his clothes he wore to the theater, and a vest gladiori for going to the sports events. His eating utensils were polished by as many teams of slaves as there were kinds of utensils. The eating vessels, drinking vessels, silver vessels, golden vessels, the vessels of rock crystal, the vessels set with precious stone. His jewels were entrusted to a crowd of servants, among whom were distinguished those in charge of his pins, those responsible for his pearls. Several varieties of slaves competed over his toilet. The bathers, the masseurs, the hairdressers, the barbers. The ceremony of receiving citizens was regulated by several kinds of ushers. The valeri, who raised the curtains to let the visitor in. The ad emission, who admitted him to his presence. The nomenclators, who called out his name so he knew who he was talking to. A heterogeneous group was employed to cook his food, lay his table, serve his dishes, ranging from the stokers of the fire, the simple cooks, the bakers, the pastry cooks, the sweetmeat makers, and including, apart from the major domos, responsible for ordering his meals, structores, the dining room attendants, triclinii, the waiters who carried in the dishes, the servants charged with removing them again, the cupbearers who offered him drink and who differed importance according to whether they held the flagon or presented the cup. And finally, the tasters whose duty was to protect the king. It goes on and on. His recreation. He had an embarrassing variety of choice between songs and choristers, the music of the orchestra, the pirouettes of the dancing women, the jests of the dwarfs, the chatterboxes, and the buffoons, and on and on and on. Romans 13. Where
Where did he get these resources? Render all, verse 7, what is due them. Tax, to whom tax is due. Custom, to whom custom. The character of the man had nothing to do with it, and it was irksome. Let me read maybe one other. Now, let me say this in favor of the emperor, because he's looked bad. But in favor of him, since his private resources and the government treasury were one and the same, he did do some good things. He said, the emperor provided the purse that financed the offices of the prefects in the provinces. He employed an immense household of slaves and freedom that we've said. He paid salaries, this is interesting, he paid salaries of soldiers throughout the empire as well as bonuses to reward troops for victories or induce them to stay loyal. I'll pay you big to kill big. A special fund provided separation pay when a soldier was honorably discharged from the army. But notice this. Most of the construction and maintenance of public buildings in the provinces was paid for to the cities, as we've seen. But the imperial treasury paid for special products. This would be the king paid for this. Harbor works, roads, military camps. Frequently, the emperors exhibited their benefits in the form of elaborate game spectacles, special handouts to all the citizens, larger ones to the rich than to the poor. For some reason, at the end of the first century CE Christian era, Trajan established a special fund to ensure specified amounts of grain to all the citizens, all the citizen children in Italy, and there was your welfare state. Trajan established a special fund to ensure specified amounts of grain to all the citizen children in Italy. So there was a whole program to feed children from the government coffers. It's interesting, isn't it? It started out so simple, 10% across the board, and when Israel departed from it, and when the other nations departed from it, unfair taxation came into the picture, and we should add one last thing. I didn't write it down. The punch point. Where did it go? Oh yeah, 1 Kings 12:4. That's close. 1 Kings 12:4. And the issue now is a new king, and there are two competing kings, Rehoboam and Jeroboam. And verse 3, they sent and called for Jeroboam, who was in Egypt. And Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, the king that was to succeed, saying, your father, Solomon, made our yoke hard. Therefore, lighten the hard service of your father, and his heavy yoke would he put upon us, and we will serve you. In other words, the king or the government became so oppressive that if you'll do something about it, we'll go in your direction. But he didn't. And they depart for several days, and the response of the government comes down in verse 7, where they're told, if you will be a servant to this people today, we'll serve them. Talking to the king, potential king, grant them their petition, speak good words to them, they'll be your servants forever. But he forsook the counsel of the elders, which they had driven with him, and consulted with the young men of the 60s, and grew up with them, and served them. So you come in the following context, and down at verse 10, they simply respond by increasing the load. In verse 10, thus you shall say to the people who spoke to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, now you make it lighter for us. But you shall speak to them, my little finger is thicker than was your father's loins. And they came back, loaded the people down with, again, slavery and taxation and loss of freedom. And what happened? Kingdom split. Kingdom of Israel split to the north and south over a tax revolt and over the oppression of a government that would not allow his citizens to respond as citizens should respond. So there's some serious teaching. And again, I think perhaps as a concluding remark, isn't it interesting that the case you could build out of these books for the corruption of the king and the emperor, and you can, unfairness and unjustness, and yet what does Paul say? Pay your taxes. Why does he say that? because there's an issue beyond the corruption of government. It's called authority. And when that is set aside, the results of revolt against that inevitably are worse than that. So the word, as far as Scripture is concerned, reform, yes. Revolt, Scripture just doesn't allow it. And I'm sure you feel with me, I have scary thoughts. Because here I am 57, and I've always been a flag-raising, waving person. And yet, I scare myself by sometimes thinking what I would like to do to Congress in Washington. I'd like to burn it to the ground. Pay your taxes. Pay your taxes. That's the issue for a Christian. We got to see beyond it, don't we? If you can't see beyond things to God, you can't function as a Christian. And Romans 13, it says you got to see behind things to God. If you can see behind things to God, then you can cool off a little bit, and you can work for change. And yet at the same time, we ultimately go right over the head of government, and we honor God, and therefore the teaching of Romans chapter 13.
Father, we're thankful tonight for your truth. We do pray for sanity in our leaders. May we who have gone so far and made so much fun of and so much light of the Scriptures recognize that they are ultimate sense and their ultimate wisdom and their ultimate truth. And so we would pray that those in authority will see the truth of your word. And may we continue to function as the church ought to function, to be a pillar and a ground of the truth and proclaim your word, praying that among those in leadership, the truth of Scripture might be recognized. In Christ's name, amen.